This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division.
Everyone, hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action now. The Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way in just days, about a week. Let me see. Let's just do the math. We're looking at 9 days until the Patriot Awards. That'll be November 6th. Few tickets are left at the Tillis Center at Long Island University. There's going to be so many surprises. It's going to be crazy. As far as the President of the United States, he's on a big trip right now. We have Senator Mark Wayne Mullen coming up at the bottom of the hour. Griff Jenkins in studio right now, fresh off Fox and Friends weekend and filling in for Lawrence today. So before we get to your calls and more, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
To be Muslim in New York is to expect indignity. But indignity does not make us distinct. There are many New Yorkers who face it. It is the tolerance of that indignity that does it.
What is he even talking about? Is this the guy that doesn't like the Jewish community, despises Israel? 9 days to go with three impactful races still up for grabs. The mayor of New York City, just heard from the front runner. Virginia, New Jersey, governor's races tighten up. We're going to look at the backstretch strategies.
Number two.
Is this a trade-off you're willing to make and continue to make, letting some Americans go hungry until these Obamacare subsidies get extended?
Well, let's be clear. We're shut down right now because Republicans are refusing to even talk to Democrats.
Really? Shut down day 27. Air travel, food stamps, worker pay, all affected. Seems like even the left-wing hosts on the Sunday shows are beginning to realize this is a Democratic foolhardy folly.
Number one.
They're not saying we have a deal. They're not saying, you know, if you have a scorecard. They're not saying just purchase $50 billion of soybeans. Or they're not saying China just agreed to stop its Navy patrols. None of that's happening.
That is true, Mike Pillsbury, and he's always skeptical, and he's right to be, and he is a China expert. President Trump in an impactful Far East trip. First stop, Malaysia, a success. Today in Japan, off to a great start. Thursday's meeting with President Xi will have huge impact on trade, our economy, and our military. And right now, the markets seem to be responding positively, already up 253 points. Hey, Griff, so far, what's different about this, and I understand Mike Pillsbury's skepticism, is China also had an optimistic statement. They says the two sides have recorded preliminary consensus on key elements of a deal.
Yeah, listen, when I read that Scott Bessent is a soybean farmer himself, I thought, man, that's the tell.
What do you mean by that? That he's an investor in a soybean farm?
He did. And Scott Bessent has said, the secretary has said that I'm a soybean farmer. Yeah. I've been hit. I've been affected. Why? Because last year.
Actually, China, you want to hear him say it? Yeah. Cut three.
I'm actually a soybean farmer, so I have felt this pain, too. And there are a couple of things happening here. One, the Chinese have substantially dropped their purchases to almost zero. So they unfortunately have been using American farmers who are amongst President Trump's biggest supporters. I think he had more than 90% support. And then this was one of the biggest crops in 20 or 30 years. So it was a perfect storm. But I think we have addressed the farmers' concerns.
Yeah, significant there. And, you know, when you look at last year, China bought $13 billion worth of soybeans. This year, as you heard from Bessent, it's zero. This is a real, you know, painful impact.
And why farmers? Because they looked at, China thinks that's the base of President Trump.
Sure. And listen, I mean, look, China is a adversary that has a lot of leverage. I mean, we're kidding ourselves if we don't approach it from that position. But at the end of the day, I think the fact that you did have Jameson Greer and Bessent get over there and get this framework on the rare earth minerals and the soybeans and other things, now they present that basically to their bosses. It's like the staff gets together, writes the bill, and then take it to the boss to get the sign off to put it into action. So will it change a little bit? Maybe. But if at least the core principles in agreement amongst the two side staff, I think we could be actually headed towards something.
So since they out of nowhere, and I was shocked by this because they were going to the technical part of the deal. I think it was like their fifth meeting, and I thought they were just going to get set to make a big announcement on this trip. And then 2 weeks ago, they come out and say, we're going to suspend all rare earth to the U.S. What are you talking about? Suspend? Where'd that come from? And they go back and forth, and there's all these different theories. And one of the theories was that President Xi didn't know about it. I don't buy into that theory, but someone underneath. But there was a firing of somebody that Bessent was dealing with on the China side since that statement. Because if you go, hey, we're going to stop rare earth, that's our phones, that's our military, that's all electronics, it's the AI.
AI.
So it was brought up to me this, to look into one area. In 72 hours after that announcement, we set up a deal with Malaysia on a middle contract. We set up a deal with Thailand to sign a processing deal. The framework, then we also went to Australia. They came here, and we agreed to a $13 billion rare earth processing. And because of their relationship with Cambodia, we got the Cambodian extraction rights, and we're beginning to move immediately to be in control of our own destiny when it comes to rare earth. So they must be saying to themselves, wow, that was our lever point. The other lever point is taking over the South China Sea. But China's real estate is collapsing. No one's living in these cities. And this new generation's not getting jobs and not available. And there's a whole bunch of people here who do not have any security net. They don't have Social Security like we have. They don't have 401ks. So they're not spending on anything because they're unsure of what's going to happen next in China.
They're also not having babies, by the way. We covered that. Remember, China was growing like crazy. Now they're not.
One-child policy.
One-child policy, the legacy of that is coming back to haunt them. But I think you touched on something important, which is China does, and you and I were talking a little bit about this before the radio show at a break on Fox and Friends, and that is China really has some strength and some leverage, if you will, insofar as doing these export controls, right? They come up with these export controls. They do that to smaller countries, and there's nothing that those countries can do. They're just getting bullied. Whereas with the U.S., we can stand up to that. We have other ways to push back. But in the big picture, which I think is often missed, it's not just China's dominance in the South China Sea, but look, China has shipping lanes worldwide. We are playing catch up on that. We are seeing President Trump and the administration really lean into trying to take over dominance of the Western Hemisphere again. We're going to hear a lot more about that. Why? Because China was there. The Monroe Doctrine basically wanted to stop European colonization in the Western Hemisphere. Now, President Trump is trying to take away the influence of China.
Right. Also, TikTok deal, that looks like it's done, we think, but I'd like to see the details of it. We own 8% of it. The algorithm comes here. China will own 20%, but everyone wants to know, are they going to be controlling it? And I think that's going to, we have to see the whole deal in front of us. Here's what Congressman John Molinar said from Michigan when asked about this China deal. Remember, Congress passed a law that they said, we got to get rid of it, or they got to get banned in the U.S. if they don't sell it. Cut nine.
As long as the Chinese are involved, I think there's reasons for distrust. And
even with the 20% stake,
I'm still concerned about it. Quite frankly, you know, the Chinese report to the Chinese Communist Party, and they will leverage every advantage they get. But the president has set a goal of making this available to the American people, following the law that was passed in a bipartisan way. And I trust that they are doing that.
And my main problem with this is not only with the data they can get from us and find out what we think and have manipulate us, let alone our Social Security numbers and things to that effect, but I also worry about their manipulating the news feed. They're finding out and actually choreographing what the next generation, since mostly young people use TikTok, 176 million they say are their users, you're not going to see any positive Israel stories. You're not going to see any positive Taiwan stories. You're not going to see, when we're in tough times with China, you're not going to see much promising American stories, but it won't be flagrant. It'll be subtle. And that's how they can mold the American mind. There's laws against it with networks. Mm-hmm. We got to do the same thing with apps.
Well, and the argument is that it's the algorithm. The algorithm does that, right? Because TikTok in China is very different than TikTok in the U.S. In the U.S., we get like...
Would you think it's an honest algorithm? They can work that algorithm to manipulate what we see.
In American hands, it might be trustworthy. And I think your spyware... I mean, remember, so many of the people that are now supporting President Trump on TikTok were the biggest critics, senators, congressmen. They were saying, you know, we got to get rid of it, and hence the law to get rid of TikTok altogether. But I was at Mar-a-Lago during the transition, just happened to be as a reporter covering for that week, and President Trump had a conversation or a press conference. And one of the reporters said, hey, what about TikTok? All of a sudden he said, you know, I kind of like TikTok. TikTok was good. We're going to save TikTok. Now here we are, however many months later, with a possible deal out there. At the end of the day, you know, I got on TikTok during COVID, Brian, to just participate with my daughters who love TikTok. It is the young generation. And ultimately, I don't know how you completely alleviate the Chinese threat of somehow being able to do the spyware. But in terms of the algorithm and programming, I think you could probably get control of that.
Yeah, I'll have to see. I need some tech experts to analyze this deal and let me know, because I saw Mike Gallagher as well as leading Democrats agree on one thing, that this is bad for America, and they have a different version of TikTok in China, and they don't have Facebook in China. They don't have Twitter in China. There's a reason. They have no interest in their people seeing other points of view that they can't control.
Well, and, you know, at the end of the day, with, you know, 25-30% or more of all of our young people getting their news, their information from TikTok, not necessarily Facebook or Instagram, but specifically the TikTokers, you can't compete with the reality, so you got to lean into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we just had Senator Lindsey Graham on earlier, and this statement about the Venezuela strikes, when I see these people are just so out of their minds with everything the president does is wrong. And now Ruben Gallego on over the weekend, because he's a veteran, he likes to point out that Donald Trump isn't, which any type of tact on Vietnam and the whole draft thing, I think is done, but not to Gallego. He says this about what the president's doing, blowing up these drug ships and putting our hardware into in and around Venezuela. Cut 31.
No, it's murder. It's very simple. If this president feels that they're doing something illegally, then he should be using the Coast Guard. If there's an act of war, then you use our military, and then you come and talk to us first. But this is murder. It's sanctioned murder that he is doing that. And it's very simple for someone like him to talk about killing people or doing something in the name of war. He's never actually served. He's never actually pulled a trigger. And it's very dangerous what he's doing.
I mean, did he feel that way about Barack Obama blowing up people all around the world in Syria, Alawaki, you know, in Africa? I mean, I don't think that he weighed in when he was in Congress. Do you?
No. And, you know, that I heard that soundbite this morning and I was blown away, because the president has literally changed the paradigm. For years, it was, as Gallego says, a law enforcement footing, right? They would go out with Coast Guard. They would go out and apprehend, interdict, drug interdiction. DEA did a lot of work. But how successful was that? It put a tiny dent in the millions of Americans that have died from drug overdoses, fentanyl, cocaine, heroin, you name it. Now, the president, and particularly in labeling, you know, many of these organizations as terrorist organizations, FTOs, now the president said, no, we're not going to arrest you anymore. You're going to be, quote, dead, in the president's words. And over the weekend, Tulsi Gabbard came on with us, Brian, and she said, this is the director of national intelligence, she said that now the National Counterterrorism Center, the NCTC, is actually getting involved, helping out. This is the organization.
And the CIA's there anyway.
That could, you know, map who the terror organizations were in the Middle East. They're applying that now to the cartels and organizations bringing drugs into the U.S.
Lindsey Graham was direct with us, and he said basically it's the most irresponsible thing that he's heard from a senator to date. And he also said this, cut 33.
You got a commander in chief that's not going to put up with this crap. We're not going to sit on the sidelines and watch boats full of drugs come to our country. We're going to blow them up and kill the people that want to poison America. And we're now going to expand operations, I think, to the land. So please be clear about what I'm saying today. President Donald Trump sees Venezuela and Colombia as direct threats to our country because they house narco-terrorist organizations. The leader of Venezuela is an indicted drug dealer in American courts. So, yeah, the game is changing.
Your thoughts?
My thoughts are you just made news there because striking on land we haven't seen. But so far with the boats, the narco-terror boats, we've seen 10 taken out, 43 people killed, and it is sending such a different message to those organizations that this is going to continue. This is now how it's going to be. And so we'll see if this moves into the land stuff. That does change things a little bit. But one thing's for sure, this is a total paradigm shift in how they deal with the drug
cartels. So I'll see you on Wednesday on Fox and Friends. Where else can we see you, Griff?
I'll be with you and Outnumbered tomorrow.
Outnumbered tomorrow. Fantastic. Yep. Back in a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Robert Hur was unemployable for a period because of the attacks from the Democrats and from the White House that you were at the podium leading. Have you apologized to Robert Hur?
I mean, look, what I can say to you is I saw the president every single day. It wasn't one-offs. It wasn't once in a while. I saw him every day.
Well, he is someone that was sharp. Case, have you gone back to someone who
you
had pretty sharp comments about, and we all saw a different reality in your personal capacity?
What I'm saying is my reality was this. My reality was somebody that I saw every single day who was sharp.
And you know that's not true. And she continues to say that. She's either lying that he was sharp every day or lying that she saw him every day. We know that's not possible. Now, there's been two books written, Jonathan Allen and Jake Tapper, that talked about it. We're going to hear more and more stories about this. And now we're seeing people testify with James Comer that basically said, I never saw the guy. And then he has four cabinet meetings in 4 years. And we find out his Secretary of Defense, what we all knew, was gone. It hadn't talked to him in months. And he went in the hospital and back and was in anesthesia, didn't know it. Didn't tell anybody, and it didn't even ring a bell. If Pete Hegseth disappeared for a day, Donald Trump would be beside himself. Well, where's Pete? What's going on here? I mean, that's how interactive they are. So she continues. I think she, in one way, is shocked that she's getting these questions. Number two is, I'm not impressed with the questions, because nobody was saying this when they were actually in power doing damage to the country. We have unelected staffers, some of which we will never know, making decisions, and the auto pen signing pardons, legislation, certainly not coming up with different ideas like the rescue plan, the Inflation Reduction Act, any type of gun legislation. He's not using any experience that he had in his 50 years because he's out of it. And now she's selling a book and thinks the big story is she's leaving the Democratic Party. No one even cares. She's the worst press secretary ever. I guess people would buy the book just to get the information And she's getting all the biggest interviews, the biggest platforms. She's got Colbert. I'm sure she's going to be on all the late night shows. And she still can't handle it because her narrative is so different than what we knew, than what's been confirmed. And now she wants to come out and wants everyone to think that we don't know the answer. We know the answer. Senator Markwayne Mullen next. We're going to talk about what President Trump is doing overseas, already making big gains while we are shut out here at home. What's going to break the deadlock? We're going to talk about it. Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. It gives me great pleasure to tell you that Simply Safe is now available at 50% off because you're listening to this podcast. So go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Now, why is Simply Safe so perfect? Number one, it's easily put in. Number two, it's unbelievably effective. Number three, they're using AI now to stop the break-in, not just catch the people that are doing it, but to stop them before they infiltrate your life and destroy your personal property. I personally trust these people. This is a game changer. The agents take action while the intruder is still on the outside. They confront the intruder, letting them know they're being watched on camera, and you know they're going to head for the hills because they're going to head right to prison if they don't, and hopefully they still will. There are no long-term contracts. There are no hidden fees. Get this, the U.S. News and World Report, they named them, Simply Safe, the best home security system. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what price can you put on safety? Well, Simply Safe is easy to install. They're always improving the product, and it's affordable. Why can't you be safe? The answer is, of course you can. Go get Simply Safe. Save your 50% by going to simplysafe.com/Brian. Get it.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is happening because Democrats have not agreed to vote to fund the government without the Republicans making concessions to seriously change health care policy. So is this a trade-off you're willing to make and continue to make, letting some Americans go hungry until these Obamacare subsidies get extended?
Well, let's be clear. We're shut down right now because Republicans are refusing to even talk to Democrats about a bipartisan budget bill. As you know, the reason that we didn't shut down for 4 years when Joe Biden was president was because Democrats negotiated with Republicans. And every single one of those short-term or long-term funding bills included both Democratic and Republican priorities.
No, they aren't. And you know that's not true. Is that why every single time there was a continuing resolution, Republicans would only sign on to it if they were negotiated with? Senator Markwayne Mullen, do you have that recollection as you're in Armed Services Appropriations, were there every step of the way during the Biden years?
Absolutely not. Brian, that's absolutely 100% a lie, and he knows that. The truth is we passed a clean CR, a clean continuous resolution, this same clean resolution in September of last year, when Chuck Schumer was leader of the Senate. We did the same exact clean CR in December. Nothing was added. It was clean. We did the same thing in January, and we did the same thing in March. And then we did it. We didn't do a clean CR 13 times, but we did a clean CR 6 times of the 13 times underneath Biden being in, when Biden was in office. So he knows it's a lie, but Brian, a lie from the Democrats, they think it's sexier than telling the truth because they can simply tell a lie. They assume that the media is going to cover for them and the American people are too ignorant to figure out their lie rather than actually describing the truth. The truth is they're scared of their primary elections, and this is primary season. And Chuck Schumer, who's leading the Democrat senators off this cliff, is scared of AOC, and what's crazy, Brian, is his election isn't even until 2028. But after he voted for the CR in March, a poll came out and said it showed that AOC would beat him statewide by 20%. Since then, Chuck Schumer has been nothing but a career politician worried about his reelection.
So right now, you have very few Democrats who are breaking ranks. Jared Golden is one that did. She said, I'm just uncomfortable lying about our strategy to win and shutting down the government. We've never been the party that does that. I'm not willing to shut down the government over health care subsidies for households, for households that make $300,000. I think we have a deficit problem in this country that neither party is showing any ability or political will to address. But actually, you guys did in the Big Beautiful Bill by going into the mandatory spending like Medicaid and Medicare and saying, These subsidies were never meant to last past the pandemic. That's how they were passed. And why don't people bring up the fact that the pandemic's over?
That's right. Well, also, why don't they just admit that affordable health care isn't affordable? If you look at company insurance versus the exchange insurance, the company, meaning that the company that provides insurance for their employees, versus what the subsidy insurance is for the individuals to get on the exchange, the difference in the increase since Obamacare was passed to where we are right now is three times higher. Meaning the subsidies that the federal government put in through the exchange is three times higher than private insurance through a business. Now, tell me, does that work for the American people? No. And the Democrats absolutely 100% know this. And not to mention, keep in mind, we're shut down on the discretionary spending side of the government. That means only roughly 27% of the government is actually shut down. The Medicaid, to which they're fighting about, is mandatory spending. We're not even fighting about mandatory spending. That's not even what the issue is. So they're not really even shut down to defend it because they know that through discretionary spending, we can't even affect mandatory spending. They know that to be the truth. But the fact is that that's not what they've been campaigning on. Their base has demanded that they shut down the government because they want to slow roll the economy that President Trump is putting back in place. They want the economy to fail so they can claim that capitalism doesn't work and socialism needs to be put in place. We know the Democrat Party is the party of a socialist communist now, with Mondani and Bernie Sanders leading the party.
So there's a record strain on America's air traffic controllers. SNAP benefits disappear on Friday. If it wasn't for an anonymous donor, our military would not be paid. But I think the air traffic control is an emergency. You got to get back and forth from Oklahoma, Senator. And, you know, people got to get back and forth. This is no longer a luxury item. People use planes not just for vacations. They use it to be effective business people, to do it for work and play. But now Duffy says that we're running out of air traffic controllers that were strained anyway. And now when they lose a paycheck, a lot of them are going to go to Uber Eats or something else to make ends meet because they can't go a few weeks without a paycheck. He's going to urge them not to. But when you can't get off the ground at LAX or JFK, I think that's going to really start hitting home.
Well, they already missed their first full paycheck on the 16th of October. Now they're fixing to miss their second one. Most people can't go two paychecks without and miss those without running into financial burdens. Now, a lot of these federal employees, TSA, which I'm going to be flying back to Washington, D.C. in just a few minutes. As soon as we get off the phone, I'll be headed straight to the airport. And I've got to walk through TSA, and then I've got to get on the plane. Air traffic controllers are going to be ushering our plane out, and we expect to be able to get there safely because they're going to do their job well. However, a lot of these federal employees have PTO, personal time off. If you're them, wouldn't you be saying, I'm going to take my personal time off right now? I'm going to go do Uber Eats. I'm going to go do work for one of these delivery companies. I'm going to do something to get cash in the door so I can make sure I'm not behind on my bills and start racking up, bad credit score or additional interest payments. And so, of course, they're going to do that. And I don't blame them. On all the Democrats have to do today, we're going to be voting on it again today to a clean CR. We're going to give them an opportunity to vote on a clean CR. And we'll probably later this week give them another opportunity to vote for essential employees, to which, remember, they voted against last Thursday. Last Thursday, we gave them an opportunity to vote for the air traffic controllers, to vote for the TSA, to vote for essential federal employees, not the furloughed, the essential federal employees and the military. And all but three or all but four voted against it.
So I want you to hear, when we talk about putting pressure on Venezuela, the president's really doing it. We have the USS Gerald R. Ford going into the region, destroyers refueling at the port in Trinidad, Tobago. We know we have a huge submarine presence there. We're trying to get Maduro out, it seems, in some way. But listen to, and you know, we're blowing up the drug boats that he's sending out, whether it's cocaine or fentanyl, more likely cocaine, but blew up about seven of them. Listen to Senator Ruben Gallego, Cut 31.
No, it's murder. It's very simple. If this president feels that they're doing something illegally, then he should be using the Coast Guard. If there's an act of war, then you use our military, and then you come and talk to us first. But this is murder. It's sanctioned murder.
That's sanctioned murder, he goes on to say. Senator, do you feel differently?
Yeah, absolutely. These are terrorists that are killing our brothers and sisters, our friends, our aunts and uncles and our cousins, our nieces and nephews on the streets of America right now. In 2024, because of drug overdoses with the fentanyl that's been ran into the United States, we had more deaths than the entire Vietnam War. Now, you can't tell me that's not an attack on our streets. That is domestic terrorism at its worst, and it's coming from a foreign entity, and in this case, not just Venezuela, but other cartels, but we have designated them a terrorist organization. Why would we wait until they made it to our shores? We're being proactive for the first time in decades on the drug cartels. The last time we were this proactive with the drug cartels was in the 80s with Ronald Reagan, and we saw how that stemmed the flow of drugs coming into the United States. President Trump finally has the backbone with his cabinet, with Secretary of War Hegseth, with Secretary of Secretary Rubio, and the help of the Secretary of the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, saying, "Hey, we're going to start attacking these individuals before they make it to our shores." We identify them as drug boats. We know they're drug runners. We know we designated them as a terrorist organization. We're going to attack them first. And it has started to stem the flow. Now, what the Venezuela regime has to decide to do is, are they going to stay in place? They have made billions and billions and billions of dollars. They've got the dollars, stuffed in offshore accounts. They probably got it stuffed all over China and all over Russia and other organizations or other state-run banks. They can leave. And they leave, we'll probably never be able to get them because they'll go to a state or a country that we can't extradite them from. Unless they travel outside of there, we probably won't be able to find them. And they can live a happy life and let Venezuela's people turn that back into the great country it used to be.
By the way, Thor Halvorsen, this podcast, called, you know, he was a person talking to this area, and he was talking about the Fifth Column podcast. He talked about Maduro. Listen to this, cut 38.
Maduro saw what Joe Biden did and said, excellent opportunity. Let's empty out our prisons.
It's exactly what the Cubans did.
And so he emptied out. No. The Cubans emptied out their prisons because they wanted to get rid of these criminals. Maduro emptied out the Tren de Aragua because he wanted to make a deal with them and send them into the United States to be part of his machinery of selling Venezuelan drugs in the United States. He is the head of the Tren de Aragua. Tren de Aragua is an absolute set of it's a machinery that exists in the United States. Then they collect the cash. The cash is put together in containers and it's shipped out of the United States ports in the state of Louisiana and in the state of Texas, and it goes to the Caribbean, and then it's repatriated to Venezuela. Note well, the United States did not look at containers, does not look at stuff that's leaving the United States. They look at stuff that's entering the United States. The amount of bundles of cash, pallets of cash, that have left the United States from the illegal drug trade, put together by the Tren de Aragua, as their thanks so much for Maduro, is a lot.
So does that ring true?
About 80% of it's very true. If I was watching and listening to that, I'd been like, ooh, this guy's been read in on some stuff. He knows he has resources. Not all of it's true because we do check containers leaving. But we don't check as many. There's some other stuff he said in there quite wasn't accurate, but he's 80% accurate on that. Especially when it comes to the network that was set up, understand what we're doing here. This isn't just us attacking the boats in international water that's leaving Venezuela, shipping drugs. We're not just stopping the flow. We're actually going over the network too. So when you start looking at the coordination with Kristi Noem, Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, and ICE, that's attacking the network from within, going to the cities to where the networks are at, they're going after the flow. So the ones that are distributing the drugs to our streets, they're taking them out. They're busting they're busting the drug houses. They're busting the safe houses, the cash houses, and their network. Then you have it being stopped at the same time with Tom Holland at the border, detaining and securing our border. Then you have the Coast Guard, who's actively patrolling our United States water, and then you have the military that's doing international water. This is the first time we've had a full press destroying their entire network, from the small guy on the corner that's drilling the drugs to the large guy that's sitting in the presidential house in Venezuela, and then the drug runners in between. That's how you destroy a network. And the only person that was willing to be this proactive with his cabinet was President Trump. This wouldn't have happened without President Trump. And you're seeing a huge difference in it. And for the Democrats, once again, to be defending criminals is absurd. You can't even make sense of where the Democrat Party is now, Brian. They're so crazy about their obstruction.
Well, Rand Paul
wants you to arrest him,
Senator. He wants you to arrest them and question them.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Arrest them and question them. What are you going to get? Because when you put them in prison, they will take care of themselves. That isn't how you destroy a network. You destroy a network from having a full court press, from taking their routes out, to taking their distributors out, to hitting their cash and hitting their product, and then going after the head of the snake. And that is exactly what we're doing. That's how we win the war on drugs.
Do you think it's possible to get the shutdown fixed without the president?
The president plays a very pivotal role in this, but it's impossible to get the shutdown fixed if Chuck Schumer isn't willing to release his minions and let them vote for a clean CR. There is plenty that want to vote for it. We're not negotiating on their demands with $1.5 trillion to reopen the government for a few days to allow illegals and the fraud and the waste that we cut out of the One Big Beautiful Bill to go back in.
Yep.
We don't even think it's even possible. So without Chuck Schumer coming to the realization that we're dealing with the Schumer shutdown, we're going to be stuck here for a long time.
Unbelievable. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, he's going back to work, even if the government's not running. Thanks so much, Senator.
Thanks, Brian. See you, Mike.
Armed Services and Appropriations, a lot on his plate. Let's come back with your calls, 1-866-408-7669. President is on his way to Japan. Then he's going to go to South Korea, and he's going to meet with President Xi. So it's going to be exciting. We'll break down the series of meetings that has the president off to a heck of a start on his foreign policy for his second term.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers, hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Speaking of the ballroom, I saw that the White House just released the list of donors giving money to the project. Oh. Yeah, Americans heard and were like, yeah, still not the list of names we're looking for. But you're getting closer. Some donors include Apple, Google, and Microsoft. Although when it comes to sponsoring a bigger ballroom, you think Fruit of the Loom and MeUndies would be involved.
Oh. Okay. All right, I don't get it.
You don't get that?
I don't know. I think it's dumb.
It's silly. It's funny.
But yeah, they're talking about the ballroom. There, people are obsessed with what's going on in the ballroom. I mean, obsessed. They're overreacting. They're crying. People are nuts. And I love people over the weekend saying, why is Donald Trump doing this with so many other things to be working on? He's not actually doing it. He just puts them on a mission. He already okayed the plans. He's had this vision since for years. But David Axelrod confirms the story that Donald Trump contacted him. He said, let me build you a ballroom. This tent thing in the backyard is embarrassing. You can't do it. I'll do it. I'll come up with a good price and let's have it. So David Axelrod says, okay, call the White House and talk to the secretary. So he calls the secretary, never got back to him, never got done. You know who had a similar story? Steve Jobs. He said he wanted to help out and upgrade the whole White House and the tech center there and get it up to date. Never got a call back from President Obama. He had a staffer call him, and Steve Jobs says, I'm insulted. I'm not going to do anything. Sadly, he died a couple of years later. But the ballroom is nuts. Now, what he did is cut out a lot of the red tape. People said he went around it. No, he said did everything necessary. He said, if I get private funding, I don't need government funding. I could do this myself, and I'm going to. So he did it. And then when they looked at the plans, I'm not an architect. They said, we're better off just taking down the East Wing. No one's there. No one's using it. It's old, and it's not functional. So take it down. And he did. And people just went absolutely nuts. What happens is they go, he's wrecking the White House. Yes. Have you ever done a project on your house, added something on? Sometimes you got to take up a room to take out a room in order to build a room or build on top. Soon we're going to be talking about how good it looks, how it's framed out, how it's beginning to take shape, and it'll begin the most positive story. Right now you could go look at the exact image. Do you really think the president would start a project without doing the proper research and seeing what's going to look best? So, look, and I love Eric Swalwell says, it's going to be the litmus test in who I vote for president if you don't agree to take down Trump's ballroom. Sickening.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot going on today, including a president overseas. As you know, wherever he goes, there's news to be made, good and bad, or unorthodox and orthodox. For example, before he left, we thought we were on a roll with Canada, and then we had this Ontario province president come out and put out a spot about tariffs. And the president said that's insensitive, knowing that we have a Supreme Court case about tariffs and Ronald Reagan. So I'm going to put a 10% tariff on everything Canadian. So that's unorthodox. But coming out to Malaysia and getting that greeting like that and dancing with some of the dancers that showed up to greet him on the tarmac is phenomenal. Great meeting, it seems, with the emperor, which is formality. And then he gets to see the new prime minister of Japan. Now we find out, too, there could be also a surprise meeting with Kim Jong-un. If he wants it, they would even extend the trip to do it. Would that be worth it? Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
To be Muslim in New York is to expect indignity. But indignity does not make us distinct. There are many New Yorkers who face it. It is the tolerance of that indignity.
Sounds like a pretty terrible city, isn't it? Zohran Mamdani, 9 days to go, 3 impactful races still up for grabs. The mayor of New York City, Virginia gubernatorial race in New Jersey, same thing. We'll look at the backstretch strategies.
Number two.
Is this a trade-off you're willing to make and continue to make, letting some Americans go hungry until these Obamacare subsidies get extended?
Well, let's be clear. We're shut down right now because Republicans are refusing to even talk to Democrats.
That was some of the tough questions that normally friendly interviewers were giving to Democrats over the weekend. Shutdown day 27, air travel, food stamps, worker pay, all affected. It seems like even the left-wing hosts are beginning to realize this is a Democratic foolhardy folly.
Number one.
They're not saying we have a deal. They're not saying, you know, if you have a scorecard. They're not saying just purchase $50 billion of soybeans. Or they're not saying China just agreed to stop its Navy patrols. None of that's happening.
Mike Pillsbury, a little bit skeptical about any trade deal with China. And because he's an expert in that area, I got to give him that. President Trump is an impactful Eastern trip. We've talked about that. We also know he's going to meet with President Xi, we think, on Thursday. Time shifting. The biggest trade success to date so far. Both sides are saying positive things about the prospect of getting a deal done. Would Mike Pillsbury and other people tell me, look for the word framework. If it's framework, so much can go wrong, this thing could drag out. And when it comes to the farmers, when it comes to rare earth, can't really drag it out. Joining us now is Mary O'Grady. She writes for the America's weekly column on political economics and business in Latin America, as well as Canada, that appears every Monday in the Wall Street Journal. You just watched her, too, on the Wall Street Journal report right here on the channel. Mary, welcome back.
Hi, Brian. Good morning.
Mary, it seems to me that this is the most Central and South America have been addressed by an American administration in years. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that President Trump is paying attention to the region in ways that his predecessors did not. I would say that before this, the presidents who did the most with the region tried to engage them in trade. And, of course, Donald Trump has gone in the opposite direction. But he has been focused a lot on this law and order and trying to confront the transnational criminal organizations. And that's what you're seeing right now.
What impact is it having on Venezuela?
Well, I mean, you know, before Donald Trump started moving all these military assets to the Southern Caribbean, the strategy, practiced both by Trump but by his predecessor, Joe Biden, was to negotiate with Nicolas Maduro, who's the dictator in Venezuela. And I'm really heartened by the fact that that negotiation, which is just the pure silliness and playing into the hands of the dictator, is over. I mean, Donald Trump has cut diplomatic communications with Caracas, and he's now telling them, you know, that he's going to take seriously the export of criminality and gang activity.
So we watched him. One of the deals was, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that President Biden said, look, I'm going to let Chevron go in there. We're going to take some of your oil again. If you just have a free and fair election. And Maduro said, fine. And he didn't. He lost substantially. I think by the his opponent had 70% of the vote. So he said, well, I have an idea. I'll pretend I won and I'm going to stay. And nothing happened. We get a new president. So he's illegitimately holding on to that country that is just withering while he watches. So you could honestly say he's an illegitimate leader of that country, couldn't you?
Oh, that's exactly right, for sure. As you say, I mean, I think what Maduro did not expect was that the opposition had a plan for actually documenting their victory. So they had poll watchers in all the different precincts around the country, and they saved the images of the tally sheets before they were sent to Caracas. So they had a way of showing that they had won. And he's totally illegitimate. I mean, but this is what dictators do, right? And, you know, in the early going, President Trump actually did negotiate with him. I mean, one of the reasons was because typical of these kinds of regimes, they were holding American hostages, similar to what Russia does. And Trump wanted to get them back, as Biden did, too. Biden negotiated with him, got them back. So that negotiating is over. And, of course, as is well known by everybody now, President Trump has moved quite a bit of military hardware into the Southern Caribbean. And last count, I think there's something like 6,000 sailors and Marines in, you know, personnel carriers in the region. And in addition to that, another 4,000 who are in Puerto Rico. So there's not just hardware buildup, but also fairly significant personnel buildup.
Yeah, I also saw a destroyer over in Trinidad Tobago. So they're paying attention, blew up at least seven drug boats leaving there. And people say, well, it's mostly cocaine that leaves there, not fentanyl. But the message is clear. What's it going to take to get rid of Maduro? I guess experts have said, like you in the region, that there was at least six times where everyone thought this guy's gone, but he stays. And now the president's open to, he says, we're done with, really don't have many boats to shoot at. We're going to look at land targets. What land targets?
Well, you know, this is kind of anybody's guess. I don't have any, you know, inside information about what he's looking at. But, you know, the drugs come through the Pacific, they come across the southern border, and they come through the Caribbean, right? But I think, you know, in the case of Mexico, the president for now is saying that he's getting cooperation from the president, Claudia Sheinbaum. They're allowing surveillance flights over Mexico, U.S. Unarmed drones, but to do surveillance over Mexico. And she has extradited or sent to the U.S., they call it expulsion, something like 55 wanted criminals, drug cartel members or alleged cartel members to the U.S. So she's cooperating. And when you look to Venezuela, you have the opposite. I mean, you have the administration alleging that the cartel of the Sons, which is Sons are what they put on the military shoulders of the officers. If you have, we have four-star generals, they have four-star sons. Four sons generals. And the Trump administration alleges that Maduro is at the head of that criminal organization, and also that they work in complicity with the other gang, which is called Tren de Aragua. And so he has a reason beyond, you know, just wanting democracy in Venezuela, but a reason to say, I'm linking transnational crime, and it's not just drug trafficking. You know, as you know, Brian, you've talked to me a lot over the years.
Yep.
I think the drug problem is very much of a demand problem. We have a problem of people wanting drugs in this country, and they pay for them, and we're a rich country. So a lot of that money goes to these criminal organizations. But they're engaged in all kinds of things, including, you know, coming into this country, trying to form their own gangs here in places like Aurora, Colorado, and doing things that would destabilize our society. So President Trump has a reason to, you know, be pressuring Maduro. I think the big question we have now is, you know, how much of this is noise that he's trying to intimidate him and force him to leave, and how far is he willing to go actually, as you say, on the land to try to make change? I think one of the things that is we're speculating about now is whether they might use tomahawks to actually strike cocaine labs in Venezuela. Again, I have no information about that, but if he's going for the land, that seems to be a reasonable supposition.
And we know that they welcome in Russia, and the Chinese have a big role there. Iran has a presence in that region, in that country. And in Colombia, too, the president's now targeting them and calling out their president, and he's answering in kind. Javier Pena was on with Lara Trump over the weekend. He's a retired DEA special agent, and he talked about what's happening in Colombia. Cut 35.
And remember, when we went after Pablo Escobar, we were invited by the Colombian government to help in the search for Pablo Escobar. And Steve and I lived together in the famous search block going after Pablo Escobar. This was great because that intel sharing, you're there. We're taking down traffickers in the United States, in Colombia. But now things have gotten a little bit awry with this president. And as Steve said, the guy was a former terrorist, former FARC member, and does not want to cooperate, does not want to help with the United States. So this is a serious problem.
So an ally has turned into a hindrance in the region. What can you tell us about Colombia?
Well, I would just correct him there. Gustavo Petro, who's the president of Colombia, was not a member of the FARC. He was a member of the M19. They were the terrorists who attacked the Palace of Justice in 1985. Going back to Pablo Escobar is a long reach back. I mean, Colombia has changed a lot. We helped Colombia during the time of the President Uribe's government, which was from 2002 to 2010, and we worked a very close alliance with them, and it was very successful. But of course, then they got a president, Juan Manuel Santos, who made a surrender to the FARC, and then they elected this guy, who's, you know, as you know, a former M19 terrorist, Marxist, totally Marxist. I mean, I'm actually kind of amused by the fact that anyone is surprised about what's going on in Colombia. One of the things that Petro did when he came in was he allowed the flourishing of coca plants and coca growing all over the country. I mean, it's more than doubled the amount of coca production in the country. And of course, that's the raw material for cocaine. So he's allowed the cocaine business to boom, and they make the cocaine into paste in Colombia, and they send it across to the Venezuelan border where they actually make the cocaine itself, the powder. So nothing surprising there. I think the only thing that surprised me is that Colombia held together as well as it has for the last few years. There's an election in May, and a new president will come in August. And I think, you know, the U.S. has to really hope that someone from the right will win and they'll try to restore some order in Colombia and begin working with us again.
Tell me about Argentina. And Milei, I guess his party won their midterm elections, and the president congratulated him on that. You believe that what we're doing now in helping them out with their economy is a short-term fix. It's not going to be a long-term fix. When he came in, I remember people were talking about the miracle. He came in and cut all these programs and tried to reduce inflation, and he did, and he was. But now he's find himself in tough economic times.
Yeah, I mean, it's really good news that he did as well as he did, because the alternative is the Peronists, who have continually destroyed and repeatedly destroyed that country in any way that you can imagine. I mean, think Zoran Mandami.
Got it.
So it's good news that he won. I'm concerned because I think the big mistake and the reason he's still on his back foot, even though he's made a lot of good reforms, is that he's made bad decisions about the peso, which is, I mean, that's the price of everything in a country, right? Your local currency is so central to whether your economy does well or badly. And, you know, he calls himself a libertarian, but 2 years into his presidency, he still has capital controls on, which is insane. Now, I understand why he has them, because he's afraid to float the peso, because he's afraid it will go become much weaker.
Yep.
But that's not, as you say, that's a short-term fix, not a long-term fix. And he always said that he was going to let the peso float. I mean, initially when he ran, he said he was going to dollarize. He's backtracked on that. And, you know, I think he has to find a way to get out of this problem. It's great. I'm happy that he got 40% of the vote. It shows that, you know, he's going to be able to stop the opposition from reversing his reforms that he made in the first 2 years. But now he has to govern for 2 more years. And, you know, it's funny because we think, oh, he brought down inflation. Well, inflation will end this year at 30%, more than 30% annualized, you know, and we're complaining about 3. So it came down from 200%, but his work is not done, and he has to address this monetary problem. I'm worried that, you know, all the celebrating today is to say that the $20 billion that Scott Bessent has promised him will now materialize because he won. But that's not, I mean, you can burn through those reserves mm-hmm. in a matter of months if you don't have a longer term plan. So he has to address that.
Wow. So Lisa, you know, there's a lot of focus on your beat, Central and South America, and I think it's great. And I know that,
Thank you, Brian.
78% of Republicans are for, and 82% of Trump supporting Republicans are for focusing on our backyard, and the president's doing that. Mary O'Grady with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We are coming to you after a jam-packed day of NFL football. Millions of Americans just plowed through wings, pizza, and beer like it was the East Wing of the White House. Yeah, it was another big Sunday of football. You either watched on a 50-inch screen at home or a 5-inch phone while your family went apple picking. And this is exciting. Earlier today, the New York Jets won their first game of the year. Now, that doesn't mean a lot to most teams, but here in New York, we're planning a ticker tape parade. I mean, it's happening. It is awesome. For Halloween, the Jets decided to go as a professional football team. I'm so excited.
Well, they did it. They came all the way back to do it against Cincinnati, who just beat Pittsburgh. And everyone thought they were going to be on a roll. And they go ahead and score, I think, 23 points in the fourth quarter for their first victory. And they win. Of course, they're up 39-38. There's a minute 20 left on the clock. And I thought for sure this is where the Jets are going to blow it, get in field goal range, and they lose by 2. Wrong. This time they stood up, and they were able to pull off a victory. I feel good for Aaron Glenn. Look, the Jets have problems, but they're not the worst team in football. I don't think they are anyway. And Justin Fields gets ripped by Woody Johnson, said the guy can't complete a pass. So they said Tyrod Taylor would start. Then Taylor gets hurt, and Justin Fields had to start. And to his credit, I think he was 18 to 24 or 26, 244 yards, clutch play, halfback option, touchdown pass to the end. So congratulations to the Jets. They get their first victory. And I guess now the Tonight Show is doing their shows after football?
Yeah, apparently there's 4 Sundays where they're going to be live, and this was the second one.
All right.
I know, I was thrown too. I'm like, fresh monologue on a Monday.
Pottstown, Pennsylvania. I'm going to be there this Saturday, 5 p.m., BrianKilmeade.com. If you're in the area, drive there. History, Liberty, and Laughs. Another reason to really like America in a fun, entertaining way. Don't move.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show
Occam's razor comes into play here in the sense that how many times have we spent Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday talking about the phantom call in the NFL game or the late field goal that covers the spread? A lot of times when you look for a complicated answer, it generally is the most basic one, but this has done to professional sports what the NIL did to college sports. The NIL just made it legal for all the things that were happening already illegally. You're talking about $70 billion. It's not going to change. It's not going to go away. You saw two Cleveland pitchers who were suspended this year for literally throwing games, in a sense.
So that is Curt Schilling. He was on with me on One Nation Saturday night, Sunday night, your favorite show, Sunday at 10. And I had him on with Michael Francis, who was with the Colombo crime family, and his dad was one of the founding members of it. And, you know, that dad went to jail for a long time, and so did he, and he got out because he decided to help out. But he was able to unwind, come on with us. Obviously, he's a free guy with a successful podcast. He's been in our studio before. And talk about how susceptible professional athletes are and how valuable they are in what's happening with gambling. What's going on with gambling? You got two indictments. You got two different paths. You got one is the card game with the X-ray desks and the crooked shuffler. And then you have people giving away cards, and then you have they'll have an athlete there, and they'll track big-time rollers to games because they'll think, oh, I get a chance to meet an athlete, play poker with them, and I'm great at poker. Well, they all started losing. And then over the weekend, this one story came out. This alleged victim says, I lost $1 million. But the report was Antonio Gates, one of the best tight ends to ever play the game with the San Diego Chargers, now the Los Angeles Chargers. Sports investigative journalist Pablo Latorre reported Sunday that it was Antonio Gates who allegedly rigged the game that was organized by Curtis Meeks. Curtis Meeks is the guy with the X-ray table, and he's probably one of the masterminds behind all this evil stuff, who was indicted. San Antonio Gates allegedly hosted and played in the rigged game. It happened in Miami. So these guys lost millions of dollars, and in case they wanted to act up or speak out, the mob's involved to, number one, collect, and number two, provide security and keep people's mouths shut. So when I asked Michael Francis about the four crime families, not the Colombo crime family he was involved in, and how they came together, is that odd for them to come together on this? This is what he said, cut 48.
Athletes are always a target because we can get them sometimes to compromise the outcome of a game. They get in trouble, you know, quite often. I had 12 bookmakers working under me. That's why they recruited me, because they knew I had athletes gambling with me at the time. So none of this surprises me. You know, the fact that the four families are involved, you know, normally they don't do that. But, you know, they must have seen something here. And I know it spreads across a couple of states. So I can tell you this. What? I guarantee you this is only the tip of the iceberg.
Wow. So they think more is going to happen. And then over the weekend, we find out more people is coming out and saying they took advantage of me. Rasheed Wallace came out over the weekend, too. And he's somebody who was a good player in North Carolina, but he was always volatile, always getting thrown out of games. He says it's a bigger story with referees and that emails are out there and that the league covered it up. I'm saying, oh, my goodness. Now you got football involved, not football, the league, but retired player, football legend. And the NBA, we see what happens with three players, two coaches, one former player. Well, three are former players, but one coach of the Trailblazers, another coach that was a former teammate of LeBron James, able to call up LeBron James and say, hey, LeBron, you playing today? Oh, you're not. Great. Oh, just stay healthy, buddy. And then they call the bookmakers and say, hey, LeBron James is playing. LeBron James is out. His ankle's still bothering him. He's going to try to struggle through it. Now, think about LeBron James. He's not involved at all, but his name's in this because of somebody he thought was his friend. Now, why this guy, I think his name is Damon Jones, why he would think that that's a good idea. I think he made $23 million in his career. So another former member of the Genovese crime family, Anthony Arilata, said this on Fox and Friends about the mafia involved in gambling, cut 47.
The poker started getting more bigger when the casinos started coming around everywhere, popping up and, you know, all over the place. So people could go to the casinos and bet blackjack and all those type of games. But poker, people like to play poker. That's where you could get rooms to have poker games. You know, the mafia liked it because they could rake the pots. And they also like to have, like, big-name celebrities, basketball players, baseball players come as a draw, so people would be like, oh, we're playing, you know, poker with so-and-so showing up. Yeah. So it was a draw to, you know, get the game going and make the mafia money.
Yeah. So this is going to be big. You know, over the weekend, Stephen A. Smith, one of the most respected commentators in sports, came out and said, I think Trump's behind it because the basketball players took a knee or didn't vote for him or something. I don't know. And then he was called up by Cash Patel and he doubled down. He goes, listen, I think in a few months, they're going to come back and say Trump was behind it. I don't think there's any way in a million years Trump was behind it. Not in a million years. He has no interest in this. To try to unearth gambling in a sport that may predominantly vote for Kamala Harris or Joe Biden, I don't think it matters. And I don't think that's necessarily even the case. Who knows? But especially because that whole kneeling thing, that's so 2017. I mean, just like the wall. You ever hear the president bring up the wall anymore? He doesn't, because he's like, it's going to get done. You know, we're past it. And it's not going to be a big thing. And the more he brings it up, the more problems he'll have. Here's more from the Genovese crime family guy, no longer in the family, Anthony Arilata, Cup 46.
No, I wasn't surprised at all. This has been going on forever. The sports gambling, you know, casino type games, we've been doing that since the 70s and 80s, as long as I've been around. And we've been having casino night games with, you know, blackjack, slot machines, poker games.
So the thing that they were saying, and I'm not a poker player and I'm proud of it, but they said that when you're a professional poker player, there's a certain rhythm to it. You can tell if someone knows what they're doing. And evidently, when these experienced players would sit down around a table, these guys were putting all their chips in before they even had their hand. And they're thinking, what are you doing? This is the craziest thing ever. And then they kept losing, meaning the experienced guys kept losing. And they get up and they say, what the hell hit me? I know something's wrong here. And one of the guys that said, I know you guys are cheating, got up and left without paying. Basically, he was harassed for 6 months by the mob, and the threats got so great against his family, he finally just paid up. But he knew this was going on. But sooner or later, someone spoke up and spoke out, and I think there might be in damage control. I mean, the guys that they have right now are not the biggest names. And I believe that some people speculate that the Toronto Raptor, the backup player, Porter, that they grabbed, was talking. Because he, I think, better than himself, not to score so many points as a reserve player. And he didn't, my memory serves me correct. Bottom line is he got implicated, got nailed, and they assume he's going to talk. And they just want to work their way up the ladder and see how big this got. But you already got four crime families. That's pretty big. And an active coach, which is nuts. Everyone's been suspended. And as Shaquille O'Neal said on Friday, I can't believe these guys could be that stupid. They should be ashamed of themselves for hurting the game. Another point before I move on. I thought when I was talking to Curt Schilling, because I was waiting for him as we were taping on Friday, I was making small talk with him just to find out where he wanted to go with the whole betting thing. And then I was researching for the segment, and I found out that two Guardian pitchers, Pete, did you know this? Two Guardian pitchers were suspended because of pitches that they threw that people had bet on, and they found them. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So I knew that researching, and he brought it up on his own before the show started. And then he tells me that Michael Francis was brought out of prison to speak to the Phillies about the dangers of gambling and how you're going to be targeted by the mob. And he goes, I can't believe you booked him. So I let them connect on camera and say, do you remember the last time? He goes, you came and spoke to my team. And we were so like scared to death after that about it, and on the lookout. We can't believe, but we understand why people would do it.
Yeah, and Francis, to his credit too, he now focuses on college kids. I heard him talk about how he goes to seminars in colleges about the dangers of gambling, and he gets so many of them that come to him that he helps them out. Either they have an addiction or they're in a bad way.
See, I get the addiction. So people say, well, if you're making $100 million, why are you gambling with $25,000? Well, it's addictions. Like, you know, you have a family of four, but yet you did drugs and drove into a, you know, you drove into a, you drove in the wrong way in traffic. Why would you do that? It's like you're addicted. So when you have, I'm not excusing the addiction behavior, but that's typical. It makes no sense because you feed the addiction first. But when you're just doing it to be competitive or someone comes up to you, goes, yeah, I'll go do that. And then Jim Trusty says, my client, Terry Rozier, doesn't even gamble. What? What are you doing? So if you really don't have a gambling problem and you're making $23 million a year and you're doing something for $25,000, on the promise of something getting bigger than that, but that's pretty much all legal. So if it gets bigger, it just becomes a bigger crime.
There's also the blackmail aspect, because sometimes it may not be about the money. They can have something over a player. And how do you, do this for us otherwise?
If that happens, if we allow pro players listen to us. If you're being exhorted right now by the mob, go to the cops and tell them what's going on, and maybe we can plot and plan to get out of it while giving up some people. So lastly, just a couple of things. Bill Maher never does not give up some newsworthy things. For example, he likes to pull in politicians. And one thing I heard with Governor Shapiro, I thought Shapiro was going to be good about a few months ago, but Shapiro was like just a program. You hit a button and he just says stuff. Totally programmed. So the other person that the Democrats, he's not a high profile, just highly successful, is Governor Beshear. Now, everyone gets mad in Kentucky when I say that he's moderate because they say he's not moderate. All right. All I can tell you is he's got like 60 to 70% approval rating in a Republican state. At the very least, give him credit for that. So he sits down with Bill Maher, and Bill Maher starts asking some of the questions. Can you focus on the things that matter? You know, and when it comes to trans athletes, what are you doing? Basically, you're for it, you fought against it, you pushed back against it, your legislature tried to ban men in women's locker rooms, and you fought back against it. Here he is rationalizing it, and then I'll get to other people that have put their hat in a ring already for 2028. Here's cut 45.
You have this very high approval rating in your state, and yet it's a conservative state, and you vetoed two gender bills that the legislature overrode. Which will do you well in the Democratic primary. Just briefly describe what those bills were and what your reasoning is on this.
Yeah, those were both bills that mainly addressed our LGBTQ population. They were mean. They were unnecessary. Most of the time, they were meant to score political points and or hurt me in a 2023
what
election.
What did they say?
They were trying to eliminate different types of therapies, both for adults and for kids. And I think that there can be certain...
What about sex change?
Oh, no. Certain limitations, certainly for kids, I think, are...
What about girls in sports?
There was a bill on that, but here's the thing. I care too much about sports to want to let government run them. You look at where we were in Kentucky, and we didn't have a single issue that you saw in the rest of the country.
This is so typical. It rarely happens. That's what they said that failed in 2024. Well, it just rarely happens. The Republicans are making it up. It's happening all over. I mean, you have a volleyball player in college the other day. You have this incident again in Virginia. Right now, for whatever awkward period, you don't have anything in here. But by saying, I don't want government to legislate. No, as you're a governor, that's some of the things you get involved in. You can make a statement on this. Trans people in girls' sports are going to get their own bathroom. You want to provide some money for it, that's fine. But just don't traumatize the girls or ruin their sport. Don't say government doesn't get involved. Since when does a Democrat feel like government can't get involved? Dumb answers to easy questions. So this guy's got a problem. Now, I actually don't even, I'll go against Bill Maher here. I actually don't think that's a good answer for the Democratic primary. I don't. Because Kamala Harris got killed on this. And for those people that want to win the primary and win the general, they know if they get pigeonholed into these situations, they're never going to get out of them. J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, Governor DeSantis will just pound them into oblivion. So there you go. Lastly, it looks like Governor Gavin Newsom told CBS, I'd be lying to you if I said, yeah, I wasn't thinking about running. And he said after the midterms, and Kamala Harris tells the BBC the same thing. That is a dream answer. Now, Newsom would be more formidable than Harris. But for Harris, who's leading in the polls right now, believe me, Republicans are going to stay out of her way. They should, whatever they do, let Democrats attack her because she's lazy, doesn't study the issues. She has no accomplishments, terrible vice president, awful candidate, and a complainer while blowing over $1 billion in what was it? It's 170 in something like 107 days or 207 days, over $1 billion. She ended losing every battleground state, something like 500 plus counties, losing by 80, 90 points in the Electoral College, losing the popular vote, and ending up in debt. So please, if you are a Republican, don't say anything bad about Kamala Harris. Back in a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is a very bad actor sitting on top of the world's largest known reserves of oil, plus the critical minerals that will fuel the 21st century economy. and he's in bed with our strategic competitors.
And how has he been able to cling to power for as long as he has?
I mean, let's be very clear. This is a criminal organization masquerading as a government. This is an individual who is under indictment for narcotics trafficking, commits human rights violations, someone who has used the apparatus of the state to throw people in jail, to torture them, to kill them.
So that is 60 Minutes last night. That was Ambassador James Story, the last U.S. diplomat in Venezuela. Remember, they were kicked out of Venezuela by Hugo Chavez. And then we got back in there. They nationalized all the oil wells and took over all, like Mobil and Chevron. They just took everything. Took some people, put them in jail, some Americans, let them go. And then we tried to talk them into not being idiots, and it didn't work. Hugo Chavez came here. He smelled sulfur. He harangued George W. Bush. But we were so focused on the international war on terror, and we should have been Iraq and Afghanistan. We weren't focused on him. The good news is Hugo Chavez got brain cancer and died because he was a malignant tumor on that country. The bad news is the former bus driver and aide, Maduro, takes over. And this knucklehead has made everything substantially worse while insulating himself with his army and his personal guards. They said roughly six times they thought that this guy was ousted and he stuck around. But he's never been under this type of sustained pressure by the American military presence. The blowing up of seven or eight boats, the fishing boats full of drugs. And you could see a lot of these drugs floating on the water. Now, what I'd love to see the administration do is just brief Congress. There's some reasonable people in Congress when it comes to international relations who also see eye to eye on the president on China, on Iran. Now, as the president is getting fed up with Putin, with Ukraine. And I think they would understand the problem we have in Venezuela. I don't think everyone knows that that's not a Republican problem. They don't like that Trump is blowing up ships, but they didn't mind when Barack Obama was blowing up terrorists because he didn't want to put anyone in Gitmo. So he just killed them and everybody with them. I was not complaining about that. And I'm not complaining about this. Here's more from Phil Gunnarsson. He's the crisis group senior analyst, focusing primarily on this situation in Venezuela. And by the way, it's also going to include Colombia. Real quick, cut 37.
Is there any guarantee that the transition will be peaceful?
There's no guarantee at all. And in fact, one of the things that worries me most is that there's been no apparent negotiation with a key element in all of this story, which is the Venezuelan armed forces. If Venezuelan armed forces don't go along with this, and by the armed forces, I really mean the high command, the people who give the orders, then there's a possibility, perhaps the armed forces might split, there's a possibility they might oppose a new government coming in.
He says well-armed Colombian guerrilla groups that Maduro allows to operate in Venezuela might also resist a change in power.
And you might have a guerrilla war in there. We've had way too much experience with that. Talk about experience, history, liberty, and laughs. Saturday, come on everybody in and around Pennsylvania, Pottstown, Pennsylvania, this beautiful ballroom. We're almost sold out. I want to see everybody in person, and they're going to stream it on Fox Nation, BrianKilmeade.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from New York, New York, where everyone's focused again, not because of Broadway, not because of all of everything it offers, the banking system, the financial center, really because we got this mayor's race here that's kind of scaring the heck out of, I think, more Democrats than Republicans, and I'll explain why. We are going to also be following the president's trip overseas. Everything's backwards now, so there's really a lot of things happening, maybe 4 in the morning, 3 in the morning. And was able to contact, I was able to contact the president this morning, and he is really upbeat about this trip and the type of deal that could be waiting for us on Thursday. And rare earth, what we're doing behind the scenes to get rare earth, to give us leverage over China, should they go off the rails again, is really inspiring. This hour, we're going to be joined by Tammy Overby, sits on the board of the boards of the Korea Society and the U.S. Asia Institute, of the Advisory Council of the Korea Economic Institute. Now, I knew she'd be a great guest, but now it's going to be even better because we're finding out the president is kind of going to contact Kim Jong-un, North Korea, and possibly find a way to meet. Tommy Lahren's also going to be with us. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
To be Muslim in New York is to expect indignity. But indignity does not make us distinct. There are many New Yorkers who face it. It is the tolerance of that indignity that does.
Do you believe this guy? He wants to make the story of New York, the indignity of being Muslim, as a Muslim who wants to run New York. 9 days to go with three impactful races still up for grabs. The race I just mentioned, Virginia and New Jersey, the governor's races, anything but a done deal.
Number two.
Is this a trade-off you're willing to make and continue to make, letting some Americans go hungry until these Obamacare subsidies get extended?
Well, let's be clear. We're shut down right now because Republicans are refusing to even talk to Democrats.
Let's be clear. That's not the case. But Senator Chris Murphy is not used to tough questions. Shutdown day 27. Air travel, food stamps, worker pay, all affected. Seems like even the left-wing hosts are beginning to realize this is really a Democratic-inspired stoppage, and it's got to end.
Number one.
They're not saying we have a deal. They're not saying, you know, if you have a scorecard, they're not saying just purchase $50 billion of soybeans. Or they're not saying China just agreed to stop its Navy patrols. None of that's happening.
That is Michael Pillsbury, a great expert on China and for the Far East. President Trump's impactful Far East trip. First stop, Malaysia, a success. In Japan today, it looks like to be a big-time success. And maybe even Japan agrees to bolster up their military very much with what the new prime minister wants to do when she was campaigning. And now a meeting on Thursday, time shifted, with the Chinese leader. And it looks like both sides are saying things that the framework has been done. I don't want to fall for anything, especially because this thing could go off the rails quickly ahead of the big summit. Tammy Overby joins us now. Tammy, what do you think so far?
I think the president is off to a very productive trip. It's going to be a long trip, but he signed several trade deals and critical mineral deals in Malaysia yesterday. So I think we're off to a great week.
In terms of, this is what Mike Pompeo, the former Secretary of State, told me today. He goes, Brian, look out for that word framework, because there's so much to fill in when they say framework, especially with the Chinese. But they have been drilling down on specific things like TikTok. They have been drilling down by, they're talking about soybeans. And Bessent basically said, I got some good news for the farmers when it comes to soybeans. And that's just purchase what you need. We have the best product at the best price, right?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The framework deals, there is more to be done. But he's also announcing some done deals. Malaysia and Cambodia are done. He did say that Vietnam and Thailand, okay, those are framework agreements. There's still more to do. But with a country as big as China and all the challenges we face, frankly, a framework agreement that gets us another delay in the tariffs is a good thing. And again, I'm really encouraged by the stuff I'm hearing about critical minerals, signing deals with Malaysia, with Cambodia, with Thailand. This is great for America.
So this is so interesting. So a lot of times people have cautioned me, too, who are geologists. When people say, well, we got a rare earth deal, they say, well, so much has to be done. You got to mine it. You got to refine it. You got to mill it. Yep. And a lot of times that's got to go to other countries. And we don't have a lot of refineries and environmentalists get involved. But you are as encouraged about Malaysia and Cambodia and Australia as others are.
I am, because Malaysia, for example, is talking about also reprocessing. So they have rare earth minerals in their ground, and they want to be able to reprocess it for us. So, and again, Australia, same. So I think we're making progress. This is very complicated. So many products contain rare earths, and China for way too long has had too much of a chokehold on the world. So I'm delighted to see U.S. leadership bringing other like-minded countries together. Let's sort this out. Let's not give anybody that kind of a chokehold.
How did we let that happen? Does it astound you? And this is what you do for a living. This is the area of the world you study. We knew in the 90s, I was reading some of this thing on Bloomberg on Friday, and we had the most productive mill out in California, and we just shut it down. And we allowed GM to sell off a lot of their rare earth production facilities to China. The government said, okay, go ahead, GM, you can do it. How could not people have not said this could be a problem? Did we not anticipate this age that was coming?
You know, I think some of us got it wrong. Some people thought when China joined the WTO 20, 25 years ago, this is a great thing. They're going to be good friends, like-minded partners. Well, it didn't turn out that way. China joined, but they do everything with, you know, under the sort of Chinese way. And that's very different from the American way. We are rule followers. When we make commitments, we honor them. It's not true in all parts of the world. So I think some people just got it wrong.
And very smart people, too. And some of which are Henry Kissinger, correct?
Exactly. I mean, you know, again, China is a huge player. They're the second largest economy. They're growing their military so fast. We have to take them seriously. But we also need to realize that the rest of the world is also very worried about China, and they trust America. So we need to ensure that our alliances and our relationships with these like-minded countries remain strong.
This is why you're optimistic and I'm optimistic. I listened to Scott Bessent, and this is what he said. He said it on three separate channels. I think he wants to get that across to the markets. Cut one.
So this was the fifth meeting that I've had with my Chinese counterpart, the Vice Premier, Hu Lifeng, and we covered a wide range of issues, and I think we've reached a substantial framework for the two leaders who will meet in Korea next Thursday. So, you know, on the table... the president had given me maximum leverage when he threatened 100% tariffs if the Chinese imposed their rare earth global export controls. So I think we have averted that, so that the tariffs will be averted.
So he thinks that worked. Now, let me ask you, where are the Chinese vulnerable? Looking at their economy, where are they vulnerable, maybe like they haven't been in the past?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that the Trump administration is really drilling down deep in. On technology, they still need our technology. Whether, they're making some good chips, and DeepSeek, I think, shocked a lot of Americans on how advanced it was. But when you get down to the latest and greatest technology, it's still coming from the U.S. So we need to maintain that leverage and that advantage by investing more in R&D in the U.S. and making sure our American tech companies are strong, which the president seems very focused on.
The other thing is I hear about their real estate, especially commercial real estate, just withering on the vine. There's just nothing to fill up these factories. These cities remain empty, that young people aren't getting jobs. They seem unmotivated. And without a social safety net, they're unwilling to be aggressive consumers of our products. That's why smart people have told me, don't expect them to buy a whole lot of American stuff. They don't have a lot of discretionary spending, and they're concerned about their future because there is no safety net.
And that's a very good point. They're still trying to, you know, they've lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty over the last two decades, but they've got a long way to go, and they need to really increase domestic consumption. But if your citizens don't have confidence in where the country's going, they're nervous, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And again, there are not a lot of new jobs being created in China. You've got these empty apartment buildings, these empty office buildings. You know, China, they're on a charm offensive now, and they'll be this way at least for the next 18 months. They host APEC next year. Xi Jinping is gone all over Southeast Asia. He's making the rounds now around the world, and he's talking about APEC and hosting APEC, but it's really about he needs foreign investment in China.
Right, but he's not going to get many foreigners living in China. They've made it a place that is not hospitable to the outside world, and he didn't seem to care about it. And for a while, he was seemed to have gotten rid of all free market incentives. And I think he's bringing some of that back, perhaps, but you're the expert. What is the problem? Why does South Korea and Japan hate each other so much?
Okay, they got some bad history. Japan invaded South Korea in the early 1900s, and they basically took over Korea. They gave every Korean a Japanese name. They tried to erase the Korean language. So there, and you know, many people, they've heard the stories from their grandparents. So there's a lot of bad history. But thankfully, fortunately, finally, South Korea and Japan are beginning to stop looking backwards and start looking forward. And I think the U.S. has been very helpful in that, in our trilateral approach. And again, having President Trump on the ground in Japan for 2 days and then in Korea for 2 days, I think he can help continue that warm feelings, because we've got new leaders in both South Korea and Japan.
So that would help. And they have to be allies because they have a common enemy. And we know that brings people together.
Yep.
And that would be China. Now, the president said, I'm open to talking to Kim Jong-un about his nuclear program. If this guy's free, I'll go talk to him. Now, you came up through the traditional world of diplomacy. How do you feel about Trump breaking that norm, being open to it? Is that are you curious about it?
I'm fine with that. I think that as long as we're not shooting at one another, talking is good. And President Trump is, he doesn't follow the traditional pathways. He does things unexpectedly. And I know many people were shocked that he's had 3 meetings with Kim Jong-un. But I think those relationships are important. And, you know, if he can get him to the table and potentially get him to seriously talk about denuclearizing the peninsula, that would be great news for the world.
So you would be for it?
Absolutely.
So here's Scott Bessent on the excuse me, I'm going to go to Congressman John Molinar of Michigan. You hear about this TikTok deal. What I'm concerned about is a foreign country, especially our enemy, China, or our competitor, depending on what school you're in, having control of the news feed for 170 million Americans, among other things. Here is Congressman Molinar, from what we know about the deal that's about to be done. Cut 9.
As long as the Chinese are involved, I think there's reasons for distrust. And
even with the 20% stake?
I'm still concerned about it. Quite frankly, you know, the Chinese report to the Chinese Communist Party, and they will leverage every advantage they get. But the president has set a goal of making this available to the American people, following the law that was passed in a bipartisan way. And I trust that they are doing that.
So I'm skeptical, too. I don't know the details of it. I love the fact that the head of Oracle is running it, is one of the investors. And I think Lachlan Murdoch is one of the investors. Obviously, I think that's a great move. But I'm just worried about who controls the algorithm to be able to read what Americans think, how we can be manipulated. What do you know? Are you worried about the TikTok deal?
Well, Brian, like you, I'm a little bit skeptical, because as I read the TikTok data, the information about it, China will ByteDance, the Chinese company, will maintain the algorithm. And that makes me nervous, because, you know, we both know how easy it is to change that algorithm. And suddenly what I'm reading as a TikTok user, you know, it's the wrong thing, or it's being influenced by the Chinese Communist Party. So I think that is a concern. But again, I have confidence in the U.S. officials. I think they are also very worried about that. And they're doing everything they can to put in safeguards to prevent that. And, you know, let's face it, with all of the technology in our lives now, everybody knows everything about what I'm doing anyway. I mean, my Apple phone knows everything. Right.
But I do want, we would never let China buy ABC or Fox. So
Not as long as you're there, Brian.
Thank
no
you.
Way.
Right. They can buy ABC without my permission, according to reports. But I would just think we have to make a rule for the next TikTok that comes through. If it's Russian or South, I don't care who it is. You can't be a major news source in America, and the App Store can handle that. Thanks, Tammy. Great to see you. Thanks so much for your insight.
And my pleasure.
And while the president's having this trip, it's great to get insight on a region we don't know enough about, especially when it comes to Malaysia, Indonesia, and things like that. We focus on the big stops, but the little ones matter too. When we come back, I'll take your calls, but also Tommy Lahren at the bottom of the hour. 1-866-408-7669.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And I think when President Trump comes back, he's going to do exactly what
Donna is talking about, which is bringing people together. I think he wants to do that. But the ultimate truth here is that the Democrats drove themselves into a cul-de-sac on this issue. They're voting down a bill that Chuck Schumer wrote, same spelling, same grammar, same bill, voted for it four times, and now wants the Republicans to eat $1.5 trillion in spending for 3 weeks of time. The whole thing is ridiculous. It's confusing to people. A lot of people don't get it. Something has to happen.
Yeah, because they were negotiating on bills, all of them, not just health care. The Democrats said, health care is the problem. Everything's going up. We have to make a stand. Well, what about everything else? The whole budget had to be voted on. 8 appropriations bills came out of the House, not put into conference. 3 were emerging from the Senate. They needed more time. Here's Mark Short, who is critical of, he used to work for Trump in the first one, but he's very critical of Trump in certain areas, but not here. Cut 16.
Democrats were pretty quiet during the Biden years when all their spending started all this inflation we're experiencing.
Well, you know, we were.
And the reality is that right now, almost every Republican voted for funding to keep government open, and almost every Democrat voted to shut down the government. So to say this is the president's fault is ridiculous. Well, the Democrats caused this shutdown. It's not to condone, you know, particular actions of the trade agenda, but to sit here and say that this is the president's fault is ridiculous.
Mark, with Democrats all due respect, caused the shutdown.
He's 100% right. But earlier that, he was against the president, what he did with Canada, and went on a rant about that. So he wasn't happy. But at the same time, he's like, he's not going to sit there and pretend that the president should be blamed for this, or that the ballroom's anything but building a ballroom, which is going to be taxpayer-free and be fun to watch to be constructed. That no one likes the destruction. So he stood up on those counts. But Mark is very loyal to Mike Pence. I think Mike Pence is a great person, too. I don't blame him anything that happened in 2020 at all. I think he did the right thing. But him and the president have had a fallout since. And Mark Short has been, I think he's a great panelist. I hope we get him on here soon. But he is not going to, he doesn't hate Donald Trump, but he doesn't look to work for him again. So he'll make any statement that is just on the right side. He's a conservative country. Remember, he did a lot of work legislatively to get all of Donald Trump's successes through in his 47th year, in his 45th term, when he was the 45th president, especially the tax plan. So it's an interesting time. All right, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, Tommy Lahren joins us. It's going to be great.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Tommy Lahren's with us, co-host of the Big Weekend Show from 5 to 8 every day. She's going to be on. Outnumbered shortly, am I in 15 minutes? And you are so loyal to the show. You said, if I have 15 minutes, I'm going to spend it with Brian. And I'm
honest. I have to come see
Brian. And with the listeners.
Yes, with the listeners, with Brian, because that gets me ready for Outnumbered.
Right.
You know?
So you're using me.
Yes.
How dare you?
But listen, I watch you all morning.
Right.
And then I come in and I get to see you in the flesh. And then I go to Outnumbered.
How many times do you look at the television, hear me say something and say, remind me not to say that?
Brian, I take a lot of inspiration from you.
Really?
And every time I turn on the TV, you're on it.
Right.
So I get a lot of inspiration over the weekend, over the week, the mornings. You're everywhere.
Well, are you enjoying your role? You know, some consistency now, two shows every weekend minimum.
6 hours.
Right.
6 hours. And then I'm all ready to go on Monday because we talked about it all weekend long. But, you know, with this news cycle, there's still new stuff that develops overnight. So never a dull moment.
So I pulled this soundbite basically for you. I watched you over the weekend. I know about your background.
Yeah.
Also about, you said farming. I thought farming, you said more ranching when it comes to beef.
Yes.
And what's going on with Argentina. But also when it comes to the farmers, you're very in touch with the agricultural community. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of optimism that they're about to get a deal on soybeans, especially with China. Here's the Treasury Secretary, cut to.
We have a regular quarterly meeting with the Chinese. It was scheduled for November 10th or before November 10th. I don't think we will have to have that. So we have been rolling the tariffs quarterly. So we agreed on that. We also agreed on substantial agriculture purchases for U.S. farmers. We agreed that the Chinese would begin to help us with the precursor chemicals for this terrible fentanyl epidemic that's ravaging our country. So I would say that it was a very good meeting overall.
And China said something very similar. So How close are the farmers, agriculture community looking at this?
Very much so. There's a lot of, and if you see them, the clips are all over social media. I think they're doing a good job of documenting it. You know, there are so many ranchers and farmers that don't want to be on social media. They don't want to be activists for themselves. They have lobbyists, but not really, especially when it comes to the ranchers. There's not a lot of lobbying for them. Let's just say that. The Forgotten Americans, that's them, the ranchers, and then to some extent the farmers as well. But there are a lot of farmers out there that they don't want subsidies, right? They don't want their crops to grow and then be left there. They want to be able to sell them. And we have the best product in the world, both farming and ranching. They want to be able to sell that. They want to be able to feed the American people. So optimistic. I believe that President Trump cares a lot about the farmer and the rancher.
That's why China's targeting them.
Right, of course.
Because they think you're getting to the president's base, so we'll target soybeans, even though we got the best and got the cheapest. Makes no sense. Now, tell me what happened with beef in Argentina.
Well, I'll tell you this. So I was hoping that the administration would reconsider this move to import more Argentine beef. It doesn't look like they are reconsidering it. But what we ask, and I'm trying to speak on behalf of the ranchers here, if there's one group of people that I feel like I can kind of speak for, it's the American rancher. Come from a ranching family. So
right now, your family has a ranch.
Yes. In South Dakota. So what the ranchers want, if you are going to import this foreign stuff, let's just label it, okay? If the American people want to buy Argentine or Brazilian or Australian or Canadian beef, that's fine. Let the consumer decide. But right now, the ranchers cannot differentiate their product from the foreign imports coming in. So the ranchers being undercut by the meat packers, it's all going into one bin, and the consumer really doesn't know where it's coming from. Now, if you want to buy something that's a little bit cheaper quality and that's okay for you and your family, that's fine. But have a label so you know. But if you are paying a premium price, you should be getting a premium product. And I believe that's American beef.
And also, you think that people will buy American if they can.
Yeah, I think most people will. Not everybody, but I think that the majority of the American people know that we have the best beef on planet Earth, made, processed, produced by American ranchers. I think that if they're able to differentiate their product, this also goes back to the meat packers. The meat packers are getting a giant gift with imported foreign beef.
Why? Why is that better than using domestic beef?
Well, they can undercut the American rancher. So if the rancher can't differentiate their product, the meat packer can set the price, because an American rancher can't say, all right, I have a premium product. It's going to be labeled product of USA. I'm going to demand more for my cattle because I believe it's a superior product. Well, they can't differentiate it. So the meat packer's like, no, I'm going to import this cheaper stuff and I'm going to pay you a cheaper price because I don't have to differentiate your product. So it's the same thing, if I can liken it to clothes, right? If you don't know if you're getting Walmart or Gucci, well, of course, the manufacturer is going to take the opportunity when the consumer doesn't know. But there's a big difference there.
It's with so much power that the farmers have, it's amazing they haven't cracked down on the meat packers.
Well, there are antitrust laws on the books that are not being enforced. Now, there was just a big settlement, a Tyson-Cargill settlement, because there was some price manipulation allegedly going on there. They need to be enforced, though. There's four meat packers that control the entire market, and that's a big reason why our American ranchers struggle and suffer. Right now, they're finally getting money for their product, and it's like people are like, no, the ranchers are making too much money. Why are ranchers the only group of people who are not allowed to make money?
Well, you mean that people have said that?
Yeah. Like, the beef's too high. These ranchers are getting rich. I promise you, you're watching too much Yellowstone. Most ranchers don't have a private chef and two helicopters. They're not driving Mercedes Benz, okay? Most ranchers are living very humbly, especially in places like where I'm from in South Dakota.
So let's talk about what's happening on the Democratic side. First off, with the predictions, is anyone you know say that the race is closer than you think with Mondami and Cuomo? I haven't heard that much. And the last poll I saw was 12 points. Do you think anything changes? Although the turnout, you live in New York City now, but is anything going to change now? Because I see this huge turnout. We have 6 million people here. 20% vote. Crazy.
But the people that are most energized are the ones that are showing up to the AOC, Bernie, Mamdani rally yesterday, thinking we're going to get free things. And the thing that to me is disheartening is that affordability is a problem. But I remind people, when you start talking about the free buses and the rent freezes and the grocery stores and all these things, free childcare, that sounds good to some people. And when you say you can just tax the rich and get it, that's not really viable anyway. He really can't do that. But even if he could, does everybody want to live in Section 8? What's this free childcare going to look like, right? What is this rent freeze? What is that going to mean for your apartment? Does everyone want to live in Section 8 style housing? I don't think so. So when he says he's going to make things free or affordable, you're not going to be getting luxury for free I would remind people of that.
$6 billion is going to cost for this health care, this child care program that he has. $652 million for free buses. And it's already, he takes over a city that's $17 billion in debt. Where's the money coming from? I'll raise taxes. We, as a mayor, you don't really have the ability to raise taxes. Right. You might have a compliant governor who feels as though the whole legislature is going left wing, but that's a long way to go. So what he's saying is not going to ever get traction. Here's the key. And you could use this on Outnumbered. You could claim it as your own if you wish. I think Jessica Tisch is, everyone agrees, is the police commissioner who's done a fantastic job. Everybody says, I will keep her if I win. Mondami says it too. But he was also asked, he goes, why would you keep Jessica Tisch? You said you want to reform the police department. You said you want to set up this disciplinary program. She doesn't want to do that. And he says, she will do what I tell her.
Oh.
And I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's not an exact quote, but that's basically she'll do what I want. I'll be the mayor. So if Jessica Tisch, I would not serve a day with him. If she doesn't need the job, you know, it doesn't pay a lot of work, she should say, I will not serve if Mondami wins. I'll finish out the Eric Adams term, but I won't serve. And, you know, Bill Bratton tried to work with de Blasio. He couldn't. He's not going to ruin his reputation on de Blasio. He's a calamity. So how do you think about that as a last minute could make a difference?
I don't know if it would make enough of a difference. It might give some folks some cause for pause. But the big problem here is that the Democrat Party, in this deep blue place where you'd think you'd have real deep benches, the best they could come up with was Cuomo and Mondani.
I know.
That's the alternative. That's the problem here. If there was, and I use this term, good Democrat, if there was a better option for an independent or a Democrat, Cuomo, I don't think you'd be in this position. But they had all this time, and the best they could come up with was Cuomo?
Quick, on 2028, Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris said similar things. They're basically going to give it another run in 2028. And I say, hands off Kamala Harris. If you're a Republican, let her go.
Yep.
Now, one critical, you need that terrible candidate to run. Because not only is she terrible, she's lazy. And then Gavin Newsom, your thoughts, you lived out there.
Yeah. Gavin's been running for at least the last 4 years. So I don't think anybody's surprised that he's going to run for president in 2028. I think that we need them both. I think we should hype them both up. I would love to see the Democrats make such a horrible decision and nominate either one of them. Because I think both of them, we know Kamala is beatable. Gavin is beatable, too. Mm-hmm. They're... is not a better case for the Republican than look at California.
If you want to look at Tommy Lahren some more, she's going to be talking in for at least another hour at the top of the hour on Outnumber. Is that correct?
Yep. I'll be
all right.
There.
That's the promo. Tommy, great to see you.
Good to see you.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
It was also about paying the bills, man. And it was just like hustling. And so I was out there kind of raising myself, turning on the TV, started, you know, just getting obsessed, you know, sitting there with the, you know, the Wonder Bread and five stacks of,
man,
you know,
like the White Stack Bob story.
Come on. Macaroni and cheese.
Yeah. Man, I love good, man, bro. Yeah. Are you talking about me?
Young YG.
YG, but man. Every day
in the backyard, just bouncing the basketball, throwing the ball against the wall until the ball is just like fraying, man. And you're
entertaining
your
yourself.
That's it. Whole thing.
So that was Gavin Newsom being human, trying to show that he's one of the guys.
Talking about his humble beginnings.
Weren't his parents rich?
Yeah.
They were really rich, right? I mean, I just said they have the whole breakdown of him in Bloomberg. I mean, it goes on forever. And just about, and then he got into politics. He admitted cheating on his wife with his assistant, with his best friend's wife. Yeah. And he admitted it and he goes, I made a mistake.
Oops.
Yeah. So I know they talked about that. So people are going to find out way too much about him. And I think I loved his approach originally. I thought, wow, he's going to interview a bunch of Republicans, Steve Bannon, Charlie Kirk, and others. And then something happened where he realized, I'm only getting criticized for doing this, so I'm just going to be a troll to President Trump. Now, get some followers, gets people talking. I think you're fighting around the wrong guy. If you were going one-on-one on Trump and you want to play Trump's game, it's never worked on any opponent. You know, Joe Biden beat Trump because of 2020, the shadow banning, and everything else that was going on behind the scenes, the crazy impeachment, the Russia stuff, then the pandemic, and all the questions. And they said, we just want a fresh start. But Trump was about to win by about, you know, running away. Nobody even wanted to run against Trump in 2020 before the pandemic hit. Remember, they just got a China deal, phase one. Then they passed the economic reform, the big tax reform. And then they were just looking for an opponent. I mean, Joe Biden could have stepped up. He would have gotten crushed. As you know, he wouldn't have lasted the primary. But when the pandemic started, it allowed everything else to happen. A guy like that to squeak through because it couldn't really test other candidates. Picks Kamala Harris for a bizarre reason, for all DEI purposes. Terrible running mate. And that's where he got what we got. So, but that's Gavin Newsom. He's out there. Kamala Harris is selling herself. And I can't believe that she thinks that she can resonate. But I also thought KJP's book is such an abomination and it's such a miss. She wants out of her book the story to be, I'm leaving the Democratic Party and I'm going to be independent. Nobody cares. You were a bad press secretary, an ineffective one. But I thought the empathy point would have been, I never met with them. I never knew exactly what was going on. And I had to go out there and face you people. Instead, she says, the guy I met with every day was great. I don't know, except for that guy. I didn't recognize the guy in the debate stage. It wasn't like that behind the scenes. Now, the great thing is that other people have said he was a mess behind the scenes. Could only work 4 hours a day. Understood? You watched him on foreign trips. He'd have one meeting, and then when the dinners came out, when you really mix and start create bonds, he was asleep. That's when people were not reporting what we were seeing as a guy can barely move. And it's an exhausting job being president. So remember when Robert Hur came out with his report and basically said, yeah, he took documents knowingly. He did it because we have him on tape talking to his ghostwriter, doing his biography. You're going to like all this top secret stuff I have behind the couch. So Robert Hur does the report. Remember this. And he says, I'm not recommending that we prosecute him because he's going to look sympathetic to a jury because he's an old man who dealt with a bad memory. Repeating himself multiple times. I listened to the tapes. I read these transcripts. It is absolutely awful. So remember, KJP ripped this guy, as in most Democrats. And she was finally asked about that on MSNBC, of all places, over the weekend. Cut 44.
Robert Hur was unemployable for a period because of the attacks from the Democrats and from the White House that you were at the podium leading. Have you apologized to Robert Hur?
I mean, look, what I can say to you is I saw the president every single day. It wasn't one-offs. It wasn't once in a while. I saw him every day. Well, he is someone that was sharp.
Case, have you gone back to someone
who sharp.
Sharp comments about, and we all saw a different reality in your personal capacity?
What I'm saying is my reality was this. My reality was somebody that I saw every single day who was sharp.
Absolutely terrible. And of all the books out there, do not buy that one. She's getting all the biggest shows. If she flies up the rankings, it would really be, you should have hired, you should demand much more candor. Whatever it is, you can't come out and say that she didn't see the failings that everybody else saw, that the cabinet was unable to perceive. Well, you're going to see Mayor Pete say, I never met with the guy. That's going to be his only out. You're going to see anybody who wants to run for office say, yeah, I really had nothing to do with him. Now, Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, they're operatives. They'll be pundits. They'll be writers. They'll be professors. They're not going to run for office. So they could say whatever they want. For the other people that want a political career, that is not the answer you give. I never met with the guy. I rarely saw the guy. I thought my best thing I could do is to do my job. We had four cabinet meetings in all those years. And out of four, what President Trump did, putting the auto pen in a frame because they're going to do something to his frame if a Democrat ever wins and they have that walk of fame of all the presidents outdoors in the veranda in the famous corridor. But Otto Penn really did everything from those pardons on down in those last days. So I think that's really important. The guy that I think is going to be running too is Rahm Emanuel. I think he's doing the smart thing. He's hopping on. I think he should hop on Fox too. I don't know if he's being paid at CNN. He hops on CNN on every issue, especially in the Far East. This guy's got an expertise in Japan. Tell me what the deal is. Because on some of the things that are happening, like, for example, the peace deal with the Palestinians and the Israelis and the rest of the Arab world, he has to compliment. He has to. When it comes to the city of Chicago and murders, oh, we don't need all that help. Yeah, you do need that help. So what he's going to say, he's got to get involved. Don't avoid it. Get involved on all the issues. That's what Trump did. Every week he would call into Fox and Friends. He'd have about 5 minutes, come 5 minutes early. He goes, what do you want to talk about? We're not at, you don't text him. You don't email him. You don't talk to a staffer. He would get on with the producer and say, what do you want to talk about? And almost never would he nix a topic. Almost never. I think there was one topic he nixed just because of a personal issue that he was having with people suing each other. But that was it. And he'd be instantly able to talk. And guess what? Coming on Fox and Friends, even on a phoner, that soundbite would make news all day because you'd respond to the biggest stories of the day. I mean, Governor Beshear has got to do that. Governor Shapiro has got to go do that. You know, we don't know who else is going to emerge. Newsom's got to do that. But just attacking Trump is not going to work. I think people have higher standards than that. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, this Saturday at 5 o'clock in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, History, Liberty, and Laughs with Fox Nation, Brian Kilmeade Show. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets, too.